All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Monday, October 19th, 2015. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Monday, everybody. It is a chilly one here in upstate New York. I woke up this morning. It was 31 degrees. It is now 39 and somewhat sunny here in upstate New York. I don't think it's going to get too much warmer today, but they did say we're going to get back up into the 60s. I saw that some places in New York actually got snow this weekend. We had a few flakes in the sky, but nothing stuck. But it's coming, people. It's coming pretty quickly. And I am not looking forward to that at all. So where do we leave off on Friday? We titled the show Life 2.0, $100 cut and paste DNA for the cure. And yeah, we looked at some pretty crazy stuff, some of the new evolutions for gene drive and how easy it's getting to use the CRISPR technology to be able to very accurately cut and paste out DNA and replace with other things, not only in humans, but in plants as well. We had looked at a little bit of a documentary that really talked about how they were genetically modifying plants and kind of pointed to how that was exactly what they were doing in humans. And I want to get more into that probably toward the end of the week. I still got to watch that hour and 25 minute documentary, but there was some really good information in there I wanted to share. But what we're going to look at today is still along these lines. I found some disturbing stuff today. This morning when I was kind of digging through what I had posted this weekend, we've talked a lot about a lot of the technological things that are happening right now with the federal government and some of these new quote-unquote blueprints that they're putting into place, the money that they are investing in agencies, including the National Institutes of Health, to help us become healthier, better humans. We have the biotechnology or bioeconomy blueprint that's been rolled out here as well as in other countries that's accelerating, the way they say it, innovations in healthcare. And of course, they are all in bed with Big Pharma. Big Pharma's getting sprinkle funding from not only federal government, but from places like DARPA for developing cures, let's say, quote unquote, cures to maybe some future biological attack. You know, we have them working under the Project BioShield where they can make these mad science vaccines and test them in the event of an emergency. But it's gotten beyond that now because they don't need emergencies anymore for any of this. So between the bioeconomy blueprint, the electronic medical health records, there was a supercomputing initiative also at a federal level. Of course, they are globally working on mapping the genome and the brain project. It starts to paint a very scary picture. So I wanted to kind of dig in deep to some of these and connect some dots because there's some. And of course, we have Kurzweil. Oh, it wants me to reboot my computer again. Hold on. Postpone again. Of course, we have Google and Kurzweil at the helm of Google's engineering division. And Google has now created Alphabet and put all of their little psychotic entities underneath that. Some pretty scary stuff. So anyway, let's start here. This was a story that I found called the U.S. Bioeconomy Blueprint, the 10-Minute Guide. This is back from April of 2012. And that was when that bioeconomy blueprint was first released. It says the Obama administration releases its long-awaited historic strategic plan for the bioeconomy and U.S. economic revival from advances in health sciences, agriculture, industrial biotechnologies, and advanced biofuels. And wow, doesn't that sound so nice? But remember, too, a video that we heard, I believe, on Wednesday and Friday that came out of Congress for pushing the 21st Century Cures Act. Remember, they want the FDA to drop their pants and not do any of the little bit of testing that they do right now for drugs and devices going onto the market. They want to be able to open it up so it is direct to consumer from biopharma to be able to do testing on willing participants and then publish a case study and use that as their proof for viability in the populace. So, you know, we, for this bioeconomy blueprint that is going to quote unquote revive the U.S. economics, we are just going to throw it all out the window and say it's anything goes. So anyway, no time to read this dense report. Well, try our full 10-minute guide to get all you need to know. So here we go. In Washington, the Obama administration released its bioeconomy blueprint outlining its strategy. And we just read this because they printed it twice. For U.S. economic revival based on U.S. technological leads in agriculture, Monsanto, biotechnology, nanobots, health sciences, big pharma, and entrepreneurism. Now, anywhere where we mix entrepreneurism with biotechnology, health sciences, and agriculture has got to make anybody worry, right? Oh, it says in today's digest, we present this 10-minute blueprint, blah, blah, blah. All right, the rationale. In the blueprint's opening pages, the administration writes, quote, decades of life sciences research and the development of increasingly powerful tools for obtaining and using biological data have brought us closer to the threshold of a previously unimaginable future. Yes. It sure has, to the dystopia that we never believed could be possible. It has brought us right to that threshold of complete and utter destruction on planet Earth as we know it. But hey, it's all in the name of entrepreneurism. It says, ready to burn liquid fuels produced directly from CO2, biodegradable plastics made not from oil but from renewable biomass, tailored food. Hey, I wonder if they're going to use body parts in the future to make biodegradable plastics. Tailored food products to meet specialized dietary requirements. And yes, there we go. That's our little 3D printed nutraceuticals made out of bug protein coming to your future, as well as personalized medical treatments based on a patient's own genomic information. Yes, that is your personalized medicine, as well as novel biosensors for real-time monitoring of the environment. And hey, believe it or not, I actually have stories to talk about every single one of those today, if we make it that far. Increasingly, scientists and engineers are looking to augment biological research with approaches from other scientific disciplines for solutions to our most demanding scientific and societal challenges, and seeing exciting options that will profoundly affect our future. Unquote. Wasn't that an elevator pitch? It most certainly was, good old Barry Satoro. In the blueprint, the administration reports, quote, according to the USDA, U.S. revenues in 2010 from genetically modified crops were approximately $76 billion. It was just in 2010. Beyond agriculture, based on the best available estimate, 2010 U.S. revenues from industrial biotechnology, such as fuels, materials, chemicals, and industrial enzymes derived from genetically modified systems, were approximately $100 billion. The blueprint also notes the international success of U.S. agriculture, which produced a $42 billion trade surplus last year. And yes, let's add to that then the TPP and the TTIP to open all of those trade barriers that right now are protecting a lot of those nations from our U.S. biotechnology agriculture. Let's drop our drawers and make sure that we can increase that $42 billion trade surplus without anyone knowing, because we've removed all the labeling laws. All right, five strategic objectives from the bioeconomy blueprint. Well, let's go. The National Bioeconomy Blueprint describes five strategic objectives for a bioeconomy with the potential to generate economic growth and address societal needs. Yes, because they are such wonderful philanthropists, and they think about you and me and how difficult life is and how they're going to make it so much better, Mr. Bill Gates. Oh, God. So, number one, support the R&D investments, mad science, that will provide the foundation of the U.S. bioeconomy. Quote, coordination of the federal bioeconomy-related research activities can improve the efficiency and effectiveness of those investments and is especially important when budget growth is constrained. Yes, do more with less at a genetic level. Coordinated $100 cut and paste DNA about puts a lid on that one. Coordinated strategic programs and targeted investments will accelerate progress in biological research and technology areas. And this will in turn drive discovery for an American bioeconomy. Moving forward, coordinated, integrated R&D efforts will strategically shape the national bioeconomy R&D agenda. And you know, that's one thing that I've brought up time and time and time and time and time again. This entrepreneurship of biopharma, you know, line item budgets for R&D were historically huge. And now that we have all this federal funding going into supplementing R&D, you and me and our kids and Nana all become the guinea pigs, and R&D becomes funded by your tax dollars, making a huge profit for anyone who is invested in biopharma. Wow, how amazing is that? That in turn must be good for the economy. Number two, facilitate the transition of bioinventions. Bioinventions, that's the first time I've heard that. From research lab to market, including an increased focus on translation and regulatory sciences. Well, hey, facilitating the transition of bioinventions from research lab to market sounds a lot like the 21st Century Cures Act, where we get rid of those pesky regulatory agencies that are holding up research by making sure it's safe and just letting it go onto the market so we can start testing it in real time. Wow, how amazing is that? And our Congress is behind it. They've jumped into bed and they are selling you down the river. Says, quote, if it is to be successful and thrive, the bioeconomy will be based on a steady flow of new products, ding ding, and services that address American needs. To ensure this flow, policies must be developed and taxpayer dollars must be used responsibly to foster an ecosystem that supports discovery, innovation, and commercialization. Wow, didn't they have that little circle in that 21st Century Cares Act video that said that numerous times? It's exactly what they are selling to us. Moving forward, a dedicated commitment to translational efforts will accelerate movement of bioinventions out of laboratories and into the market. So there we go. Number three. Develop and reform regulations to reduce barriers, increase the speed and predictability of regulatory processes, and reduce costs while protecting human and environmental health. Well, yes, again, 21st Century CARES Act and reducing costs by now having the taxpayers foot the bill for all the research and development. It's just amazing how this all works out. Quote, regulations are essential for protecting human health and environment and reducing safety and security risks associated with potential misapplications of technology. Well, I would like to see where they are putting the brakes on anyone misusing technology such as CRISPR and gene drives, because right now it is mad science gone mad in every laboratory across the globe for the race to whoever is going to find the billion-dollar carrot that'll win them the booby prize. Back to the story. When they are not carefully crafted or become outdated, and this is regulatory barriers, However, they can become barriers to innovation and market expansion and discourage investment. So not only let's get the 21st Century Cure Act passed, but let's get these international trade agreements through. Wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. So we can start shipping this stuff and exporting our mad science gone mad, not only in our drugs, but in our food as well. Moving forward, improved regulatory process will help rapidly and safely achieve the promise of the future bioeconomy, which is called like an absolute dystopian transhumanism future. Number four, update training programs to align academic institution incentives with student training for national workforce needs. And yes, they are pumping bazillions of dollars into the universities right now for biotech research and getting our children to be the agents that are moving this transition to human 2.0 forward. Quote, many jobs in science and technology related businesses remain unfilled despite high rates of local unemployment. Opportunities exist to enhance training efforts at all levels to keep pace with challenging career pathways. And moving forward, federal agencies should take steps to ensure that the future bioeconomy has a sustainable and appropriately trained workforce. So let's go to the schools and not only get them trained in genomics and biotech and mad science, but let's also go in there with our surveillance state and alphabet agencies and recruit some of these kids into things such as doing, when they're able to take small amounts of DNA and slice and dice, cross-reference and put it in the database and figure out who you are. Yes, it's all of the national surveillance, soon to be international, including tech companies like Microsoft's Cyber Patrol Center, to be able to keep tabs on anything and everything we do down to a cellular level. Moving forward, federal agencies should take steps to ensure that the future bioeconomy has a sustainable and, oh yes, we already looked at that, an appropriately trained workforce. Number five, identify and support opportunities for the development of public-private partnerships and pre-competitive collaborations, which they're already doing, pulling all of these tech and biopharma companies into the big federal happy family, working on collaborative projects, as well as the universities and big boys such as the Weiss Institute at, I think that's at MIT, where they're doing things such as RoboBees and all kinds of robotics insanity, nanobots. Yeah, it's just what I want to invest in. It says partnerships enable private industry, government agencies, and academic institutions, there we go, to pool resources and expertise around an idea, which is global and biological domination, dramatically improving our chances for success. Many companies do not invest in early ideas because they are unlikely to pay off immediately. So this is one place where the government can play a crucial role. Oh, this is making me hurt. Blame it all on DARPA. DARPA is kind of like the snake's den where all of this started slithering out of. And if we make it, I have a very disturbing DARPA story that's queued up for the very end of the show here. It says, moving forward, federal agencies should provide incentives for public-private partnerships and pre-competitive collaborations to benefit the bioeconomy very broadly. So there we go. And I don't know if I really want to get into all these bullets now that gets into the specifics, but let's just look at number one because I saw DARPA's name in there. Strengthening research and development. I think we read when we first did the bioeconomy blueprint, we read some of the players that are involved. Key provisions for this are going to be the USDA, the Department of Energy, ARPA, as well as funding for biomanufacturing R&D via DARPA and the National Science Foundation. as well as further unlocking the promises of synthetic biology, we are going to have the Department of Energy's Office of Science. That gets me so excited that they are putting federal tax dollars behind this complete usurpation of biology 1.0. All right, now we're going to jump. So kind of laid the background of the bio economy blueprint. It has been full steam ahead since 2012, and now it is in your face. These plans have all hatched, and it is full frontal. I found a story that came out in March of 2015 titled "The End of Illness: How Big Data, Wearable Devices, and Nanobots Could Change Detection and Treatment." Fighting disease in both the individual and society has always been a game of catch-up. And while data collection and sharing has accelerated risk identification in the digital age, doctors and clinicians still remain stuck in reaction mode to emerging threats. That, however, is beginning to change, and the change, when it comes, will be revolutionary. Like I said, I don't even think it's going to be 10 years from now. The world as we know it is not going to look the same here very shortly. Medicine and healthcare are on the edge of a paradigm shift, an end to illness, as big data, healthcare cloud computing, wearable technology, and nanotechnology all converge to provide us with the tools to counter disease before it ever takes root. The big data approach to healthcare gathers and analyzes massive amounts of information from multiple sources to predict and mitigate emerging risks before they ever become a problem. And the industry has already taken its first steps toward this new world. Oh, look, they even used the phrase, by switching from paper to electronic medical health records. Ding, da, da, ding. And even without the impetus from looming government mandates, many medical providers have proactively begun the shift to digital records to reap the benefits to their patient care and operating costs. And yes, and to stack up on their kickbacks that they're getting from biopharma for utilizing their new fangled medicines. Digital medical records are just the beginning of healthcare revolution. But even this small step generates some big numbers by expanding big data's potential for the industry. And remember, we had also talked about genomics and the merging called eMERGE of electronic medical health records and your genomics data. This is pretty scary stuff, people. And this is already far down the way. According to the McKinsey Global Institute, a leading management consulting firm, the U.S. healthcare industry could create more than $300 billion in value annually through the creative use of big data to drive efficiency and quality. More specifically, big data could boost the industry's value by $200 billion just by helping to reduce expenditures by 8%. These financial gains only hint at the tremendous potential for improving public health by crunching data from massive numbers of electronic medical health records. Oh my God, this is all real. It is absolutely real. People used to call me a lunatic when they first started this electronic medical health records. I knew exactly where this was leading, and it's for real now. And this potential will only grow as the sources for big data balloon in number, scope, and depth. Consider wearable devices like what? Oh, your Apple iWatch or your Google device. More than 90 million wearable devices were shipped last year alone, according to ABI research. And these devices count everything from the number of steps we take to how many calories we burn. And as more consumers open their arms wide and adopt this technology and share their fitness data via real-time cloud-based social media sites, the healthcare industry will gain a massive and revolutionary new live platform for identifying and predicting risk to public health. So there we go. We knew that too. These wearable tracking devices that, you know, tell you what your heart rate is and how many steps you've walked. Right now, many people are just using ones that are in their phone, but there are these now wearable devices. We looked at some of the new Android operating system. I don't remember what that was called, but it was specifically for wearable computing. This is already in fast forward. And then add to that all of the voluntary genomics data that was given to places like 23andMe through their Ancestry consumer division that now is also being shared with the National Institute of Health. A true paradigm shift is only a step away, or perhaps a few basic algorithms away. And there we go. It's all about the algorithm, especially when talking about big data and artificial intelligence. While nanobots are still in the development phase, some basic molecular machines and nanomotors have been successfully demonstrated, and a breakthrough may be approaching in the near future. And yes, 2015 was the year they were going to be using nanobots to cure leukemia, and we're going to look at that story. Ranging in size from 0.1 to 10, and I wish I remembered, I don't know, it's one of those little angstrom units maybe, it's a UM, and very, very tiny, in other words, and able to incorporate nanoscale chemical sensors, nanobots could spell the end to illness, or at least the beginning of a new age for predictive healthcare analytics. Coupled with wearable technology, nanobots present the possibility for real-time monitoring of health and disease in the body and eventually help cure disease. And remember, this was actually something that was talked about in a document that we read from Google's Calico project, where you would have your little wristbands and the nanobots in your blood to be able to detect when changes were made that would cause disease and fix them automatically. By linking internal health data to wearable devices and ultimately to healthcare cloud computing, nanobots offer a massive new data source for detecting disease patterns in the broader population and countering them before they ever take root. The converging power of big data, cloud services, and wearable technology with nanobots cannot put an end to risk. Yeah, not at all. Who's going to be the first ones to line up for nanobots in their bloodstream? Oh, the most desperate, who are sick and dying to be the live real-time guinea pigs. And however, by providing doctors the ability to forecast and treat disease earlier in individual patients and detect and counter pandemics in the population, it will allow medical providers to operate predictively rather than reactively and put preventable illness permanently on the defensive. Now, here's the problem with this. Because this is a national initiative with the bioeconomy, and even beyond that, it's an international initiative with other countries such as Canada and Australia inking on their own bioeconomies. Guys, this is not going to be voluntary in the future. This is going to be the way that they cut down on healthcare costs and make it more efficient. They said in this, an 8% reduction in expenditures equaled a $200 billion dollar increase in profits. Well, profits before your best interests. This will become mandatory. Mark my words. All right. Here's another story. This one came out of the Washington Post in April of 2015. Tech Titan's latest project, Defy Death. For centuries, explorers have searched the world for the fountain of youth, and today's billionaires believe that they can create it using technology and data. So let's throw not only the federal government and all these institutions on board, but let's get all the world's billionaires and tech companies involved as well. And I mean, guys, how is there going to be a way to stop this train? I am grappling with how to stop this train. And it's gotten beyond the bottle. The genie is out, and now there's 10 bazillion genies trying from every way, shape, or form to get this party started, and I think it already has been, and we weren't invited. We'll get the scraps. We'll get the malformed pancakes that start at the beginning of the party. All right, let's read this. Seated at the head of a table for 12 with a view of the city's soaring skyline in San Francisco, good old Peter Thiel was deep in conversation with his guests, eclectic scientists whose research was considered radical and even heretical. Now, what a way to start a story. You get a billionaire in a room with radical, eclectic scientists. Anything that comes out of that conversation can't be good. It was 2004, and Thiel had recently made a tidy fortune selling PayPal, which he co-founded, to eBay. He had also spent what he wanted on himself. He bought a posh penthouse suite at the Four Seasons Hotel and a silver Ferrari, and was now soliciting ideas to do good with his money. Yeah, so to find a very large tax deduction. Among the guests was Cynthia Kenyon, a molecular biologist and biogerontologist who had garnered attention for doubling the lifespan of a roundworm by disabling a single gene. Aubrey de Grey, a British computer scientist turned theoretician who prophesized that medical advances would stop aging, and who... Larry Page, co-founder of an internet search darling called Google that had big ideas for improving health through the terabytes of data it has been collecting. The chatter at the dinner party meandered from the value of chocolate in one's diet to the toll of disease on the U.S. economy to merits of uploading people's memories to a computer versus cryo-freezing their bodies. I hear Kurzweil in there somewhere. Yet, the focus kept returning to one subject. Was death an inevitability or a solvable problem? I told you, the end result of all this is immortality. This is what they're shooting for. A number of guests were skeptical about achieving immortality, but science and technology could help us live longer, to say 150 years. Well, that they agreed on was worthy of a goal. Within a few months, Thiel had written checks to Kenyon and de Grey to accelerate their work, and since then has doled out millions to other researchers with what he calls breakout ideas that defy conventional wisdom. If you think you can do it very little and be very incremental, then you'll only work on very incremental things. It is self-fulfilling, Thiel said, who is now 47 and estimated to be worth $2.2 billion. It is those who have optimism about what can be done that will shape the future. Well, Thiel and the tech titans who founded Google, Facebook, eBay, Napster, and Netscape are now using their billions to rewrite the nation's science agenda and transform biomedical research. Well, ding, da-da, 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 ding. Because we have technology companies coupling with the federal government and biopharma to rewrite and transform our nation's science agenda and biomedical research. If this isn't scary, I don't know what is. Their objective is to use the tools of technology, the chips, the software programs, and, oh, look, the algorithms and big data that they used in creating an information revolution to understand and upgrade what they consider to be the most complicated piece of machinery in existence, the human body. The entrepreneurs are driven by a certitude that rebuilding, regenerating, and reprogramming patients' organs, limbs, cells, and DNA will help people live longer and better. The work they are funding includes hunting for the secrets of living organisms with insanely long lives engineering microscopic nanobots that can fix your body from the inside out, figuring out how to reprogram the DNA you were born with, and exploring ways to digitize your brain based on the theory that your mind could live long after your body expires. I believe that evolution is a true account of nature, as Theo put it. But I think we should try to escape it or transcend it in our society. Yes, we should become gods. Oracle founder Larry Ellison has proclaimed with his wish to live forever and donated more than $430 million to anti-aging research. Death has never made sense to me, he told his biographer. How can a person be there and then just vanish and not be there? During the first stages of their careers, the technologists spent their time solving problems in an industry that might seem glamorous, but that in the grand scheme of things has been built on automating mundane tasks. How to pay for a book online, how to stream a TV episode onto a phone, and how to keep tabs on friends. In contrast, they described their biomedical research ventures in heroic terms, reminiscent of science fiction plots, yeah, I'd say so, where a protagonist saves humanity from destruction through technological wizardry. Their confidence in that wizardry and their own ideas may lead them to underestimate the downsides or even the dangers, yeah, hello, that they work as of their work as they are funding, some say, science philosophers, historians, and economists. Their research into stem cells, neuroscience, genetically modified organisms and viruses, for example, tinker with nature in big ways that could easily go awry and operates in a largely unregulated space. Yes, everything I've been saying. Their work to slow or stop aging, if successful, is also likely to lead to broader societal upheaval, increasing pressure on natural resources and on the economy as people live longer, work longer, and imperil already strained entitlements such as Social Security. Right. So you know what? That's where all this eugenics research comes in. And this is me talking, but this is why we won't need to have children anymore if we can live forever. Life extension also would radically change the most important building blocks of a society, and that is the family. No one seems to be able to predict what life might be like when half a dozen or more generations are all alive simultaneously. Right, which is why there won't be half a dozen generations alive simultaneously. Maybe you can replace yourself. When you go, they'll, you know, clone you. Who knows? But I don't think that population is going to remain the same once these technologies are ready to rock and roll. Lori Zonoff, a bioethicist for Northwestern University, worries that some of the billionaires' obsessions with longevity may be driven as much by hubris as a desire to do public good, and I would think so. Hey, it's not about the poor migrants that are stranded on Hungary's border or the tent cities that are living along the borders of Syria and Turkey to make sure that their lives are better. It's not about sending food to make sure that those people have, you know, some sustenance or making sure that there's temporary shelters. No! It's all about the billionaire living forever and being in control. Quote, it's incredibly exciting and wonderful to be a part of a species that dreams big in a way, she said. But I also want to be part of a species that takes care of the poor and the dying, and I'm worried that our attention is being drawn away to a glittery future world that is fantasy and not the world that we live in. The way that entrepreneur philanthropists are transforming American society is reminiscent of the turn of the 20th century where Andrew Carnegie and good old John D. Rockefeller led a handful of wealthy industrialists to shape real change in the world. Yes, and we know that they are responsible for a lot of what we are facing right now. They set up schools and art museums and public libraries that institutionalized their ideals of democracy and equality. Well, yeah, if that's what you call it. But the philanthropists of today's Gilded Age are more numerous and became rich faster and younger than their predecessors of a century ago. Today's titans' increasing influence comes at a time of historic and growing inequity in the world, and by next year, the richest 1% of the world's population is predicted to control more than 50% of the world's wealth, according to a new Oxfam report released at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland in January. Microsoft's co-founder Bill Gates and his wife Melinda, ding ding, the wealthiest couple in the world with an estimated worth of $79.2 billion, said that they believe charitable giving is a key element working to close the gap. Yes, charitable giving in the way of vaccines and genetically modified organisms. Indeed. Nearly 130 billionaires have signed the giving pledge to give away at least half of their wealth, an estimated $700 billion. And 19 tech entrepreneurs or inventors with a net worth of $245 billion have also signed this pledge. Many of them are putting their money into healthcare and medical research. Quote, if you look back at history, Carnegie highlighted the need for libraries to be a place where everyone could go learn to read if you didn't have access to books. Philanthropy can be a place where you point to areas that could be the right government areas for investment to reduce those inequalities, said Melinda Gates in an interview earlier this year with the Washington Post. Many of the younger philanthropists cite Bill Gates' approach to giving as an inspiration. Bill Gates has inspired all of these people to get into this mad science realm. I am just so happy that he could be an inspiration. But while Gates has focused his foundation on saving those at the very early stages of life through his funding of child and maternal health initiatives, yes, eugenics and vaccines, predominantly in developing countries where they could do all kinds of testing without any of the laws that we had here, had soon to not be anymore. Many of those in the new generation are focusing on the opposite end of the human life cycle in developing nations. Gates has been very vocal in his praise of generosity of Silicon Valley's newly minted billionaires, but in January he expressed misgivings about the priority. They got bitch slapped. In a question and answer session on Reddit's online platform, Gates wrote, "It seems pretty egocentric. While we still have malaria and TB, for rich people to fund things so they can live longer," he said. Hospitals, but don't worry about it, because any of this DNA and RNAi technology will take care of all that. Hospitals and research centers have long been preferred beneficiaries of philanthropists, but instead of just writing checks to existing institutions, many of the technologists are now pioneering new approaches for how the work should be done and how to measure success. And while many of those recent efforts have in common, what many of those recent efforts have in common is a belief that computerized analysis of big data sets can deliver cures, predict outbreaks, and discover patterns that would have been impossible for the human brain to process. An off-cited example is Google's flu heat map, which is built on the idea that an improved predictor for flu activity might be clusters for searchers to say, for Tamiflu or flu symptoms collected from internet service provider IP addresses. That approach turns the traditional scientific method on its head, and in the United States, most biomedical research happens at a gradual and sometimes painfully deliberate pace. So let's get rid of all of the safety agencies. Scientists start with a hypothesis, conduct experiments to test it, and then spend years refining and analyzing the results they collect. Their conclusions typically are not published until they have been corroborated by other scientists in the rigorous process of peer review. Well, the new medical and healthcare research mines and maps huge sets of data and digital fingerprints stored when people search, swipe, text, and interact on social networks, shop and visit with doctors, and leave geographic traces of their daily movements. Supercomputers run through trillions of possible hypotheses at once and pinpoint patterns and correlations that may suggest solutions for some of the world's most vexing medical problems. And that approach has already led to the understanding of the role of thousands of genes in the human body, although scientists are not quite sure how most of that information yet is any practical purpose to medicine. For many of the tech entrepreneurs, interest in medical science is personal. Sean Parker, 34, the Napster co-founder, suffers from a life-threatening food allergy and has members in his family with severe autoimmune disorders. So he's donated millions to finding a cure for allergies and to cure and for new cancer cure therapies. Google's Sergey Brin, who is also the husband to the woman who is CEO of 23andMe Genomics. Google's Sergey Brin, 41, has proposed a new kind of science that starts with masses of DNA, how amazing, and a community of people with certain genes. Brin has a mutation of the LRRK2 gene that is associated with a higher risk of Parkinson's disease, and he said that he thinks that the new approach could be transformational. He has donated $150 million to the effort. And something interesting about Brin putting money into research for Parkinson's disease, one of the ways that they've been able to control Parkinson's, and we learned this in some of our research, is with dopamine. And if you remember, dopamine is that dangling carrot that gets us addicted to our devices. So interesting that the co-founder of Google is putting research into how to cure Parkinson's, and dopamine is a part of that equation. Quote, it is not just money, but more about driving awareness among those with the same genetic subtype, says Brin's estranged wife, I guess maybe they're not married anymore, Ann Wojcicki, who founded her own personalized genetic startup, 23andMe. No one cares if you just say that there is this gene out there, but when you can bring together a community of people who are aware of their status, then you are suddenly engaged. Several of the Silicon Valley billionaires married women with backgrounds in science or medicine, and those wives direct the philanthropy. Wojcicki, who studied biology and previously worked as a healthcare consultant, is co-head of the couple's foundation. Priscilla Chan, a pediatric resident at the University of California at San Francisco, with her husband, yes, good old Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, 30, who donated $75 million to San Francisco's General Hospital, where 70% of the patients are underinsured. Those two couples also teamed up with others to create the breakthrough prizes for scientists who make discoveries that extend human life. It's $3 million payouts given to six scientists each year, dwarf similar awards, including the Nobel Prizes, which is only currently $925,000. Pam Obelmeyer, a biologist and former research assistant at an immunology lab, co-founded Amadeyer Network with her husband, eBay's Pierre Amadeyer, who became a billionaire at 31. They have donated millions to research about resiliency, the traits that help people bounce back from illness or other adversity. Ann Page, who is now 41 and chief executive of Google, has made the biggest bet on longevity yet, founding Calico, short for the California Life Company, a secretive anti-aging research center with an investment of up to $750 million from Google. Laura Eliga Anderson, who teaches a class on strategic giving at Stanford University, is the wife is the wife of internet pioneer Mark Anderson, daughter of the real estate mangate John Anglella, and a well-known philanthropist herself, said that when many tech entrepreneurs look at the healthcare system, they see data of billions of people collected through blood tests, online profiles, food purchases, and fitness trackers. Guys, this is everything we've been talking about. Every bit of data that you've been giving up through using your swipe cards or your mobile phones or whatever, your online profiles, is now being put into one big, huge database, your dossier, I call it, to be sliced and diced to make this a better world. This isn't going to be for you and me. It's going to be for the billionaires and the governments who are all in charge, who now own all your data. When that data can be accessed and mined and utilized for good, yes, or how about bad? Who's making sure it's not being used for bad? In an instantaneous manner, she said, that would be shattering in a positive way for the system as we know it. And yes, if it could be used for bad, it would be shattering in a bad way for the system as we know it. All right. This is a very long article, and I think we might kill the whole show on this. Maybe we'll hit the nanobots part tomorrow. A big societal disaster. Well, such a moonshot ideas are tantalizing. But some prominent ethicists and scientists have been troubled by the tech titans' unwavering conviction that conquering nature, and that's what I've said, it is conquering nature and biology, is their unwavering conviction that conquering nature is desirable in the first place. And there are very few checks and balances on such initiatives. Once 2/3 of the scientific and medical research was funded by the federal government, beholding to the public good. But now 2/3 of it is funded by private industry, a growing share by billionaires accountable to no one and impatient with the pace of innovation. And remember, these guys are all in bed with government. We have this big collaboration now happening from White House edicts of science, technology, and big government all working together for the good of all. Zeloth, a Northwestern University bioethicist, said that there is a reason why science often moves slowly. Quote, making scientific progress faster does not necessarily mean better unless if you are an aging philanthropist and want an answer in your lifetime, she says. Science is about an arc of knowledge and that it can take a long time to play out. Scientists, we won't know answers for sometimes we won't know the answers for generations. And America remains deeply ambivalent about how to use new medical treatments to live radically longer lives. In a 2013 survey conducted by the Pew Research Center, 51% said that they believe treatments to slow, stop, or reverse aging would have a negative impact on society. And 2/3 of those people surveyed said that they worry that radical life extension would strain the natural resources that only wealthy people would get access to new treatments. Yeah, that's what we said. And that medical scientists would offer the treatment before they fully understood how it affects people's health. Hello, there we go. Step right up, sick and dying people, because we have a cure for you, that dangling carrot. And you don't have any other chance to live longer, so let's make you the guinea pig. We don't know if it's safe, but hey, what other chance do you have? 58% in the survey also said that treatments would allow people to live decades longer would be, quote, fundamentally unnatural, unquote. And I would second that opinion. Political theorist Francis Fukuyama, a senior fellow at Stanford and a former member of the President's Council on Bioethics, I wonder if they have that council anymore, argues that a large increase in human lifespans would take away people's motivation for the adaptation necessary for survival. He's got a point there. And in that kind of world, societal change comes to a standstill, he said. Aging dictators could stay in power for centuries. I think that research into life extension is going to end up being a big social disaster, he said in an interview. Extending the average human lifespan is a great example of something that is individually desirable by almost everyone, but collectively not a good thing. for evolutionary reasons, there is a good reason why we die when we do. Leon Cass, a physician and ethicist, poses a philosophical question. Could life be serious or meaningful without the limit of mortality? And although many scientists say that they are grateful for entrepreneurs' money and attention, some have been dismayed by what they see as Silicon Valley's superiority complex and the insistence that the current methods used to fight disease are outdated and ineffective. And they said that in that 21st Century Cure Act video. At a medical conference in August 2012, for instance, Vinod Kishore, one of Silicon Valley's most revered venture capitalists, likened the practice of medicine to witchcraft. He argued that machines are better than the average doctor, IBM Watson, and that disruption in healthcare was more likely to be driven by those outside the industry than those within the profession. So screw it. You know what? If you are in the medical profession and you have ethics, out of the way, because the lunatics now want to run the show. Some scientists also say that they are concerned that private money, which can include seven-figure research grants and salaries that are 2 to 3 times what is offered in academia, now distorts the research priorities. Preston Estep, director of gerontology for the Harvard Medical School's Personal Genome Project, says that some of the philanthropists are doing more harm than good by funding what he calls pseudoscience, approaches based more on emotional appeal than on solid research. And some of the work that is being funded by the tech crowd, he says, nobody is taking seriously. They are the smart guy. They are the smart guys, Estep said, but they are not the scientists. And guys, I think we got to end it there. Holy crap. I can't even believe it, but there's about 30 seconds left of the show. All right. Well, tomorrow we are going to continue on and look at all this nanobot research. They apparently are going to put it into people to start curing cancers. Make sure you stick around. We have Ms. Lonnie Clark up next, and it is Monday night. So we get to hear the best of from this weekend at 6 o'clock, Our Interesting Times with Tim Kelly. At 7 o'clock, Reality Bites with Neil Foster. And they had some really good guests this week. Unlock the Door with Michael Cross at 8 p.m. Eastern. Truth on the Tracks with Brandon Turbeville at 9. Cutting Through the Matrix with Alan Watt at 10 p.m. Eastern. And the Anti-Media Radio with Nick Burnaby and D.B. Schwartz at 11 p.m. Eastern. And I really hope my bumper is going to play. And I guess it's not. And I made sure that it was in there, but... if not, we'll wait until Lonnie comes on. Maybe I will sing for you. And there we go. We're 30 seconds late. All right, guys. Everybody have an awesome Monday. Stay warm. And I will catch up with you tomorrow.